You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on November 4th, 2013 from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. Ahead this hour, guest commentator Sasha joins me to discuss the Kentucky Health Insurance Exchange. Then, I assess the progress of implementing the rest of the exchange and discuss the role of government in 21st century America. All this is just ahead, right here, on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Monday and is available for download on Tuesdays at billhumphreyresearch.com/radio and from iTunes and other locations. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Email us at afdradio@gmail.com or call and leave a message with your views and questions at 347-688-6676. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. The following segment was recorded on October 29th. The remainder of the show was recorded on November 4th. Joining me this week from Maryland is guest commentator Sasha. Sasha, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Bill.
So the story that you and I are going to discuss this week is about the Affordable Care Act exchange in the state of Kentucky specifically. Obviously, there's been a lot of attention in the last several weeks, particularly after the news of the shutdown was out of the headlines, that the Affordable Care Act federal exchange at healthcare.gov has been having a lot of problems, both in terms of handling traffic and, more importantly, in terms of handling actual requests to apply for insurance, which is the whole point of it. And there's no real getting around the fact that it has had problems, but they're not insurmountable. And it's not like people are being denied health insurance right now, because it wasn't going to start anyway until January and people have until early December to enroll. And it sounds like they're in the process of fixing it, and it should be pretty much up and running for the average consumer within, you know, the next few weeks. But the there is a bigger story here, which is that that's the federal version, and states were also allowed to create their own insurance exchanges. Now, a whole bunch of states, as we've talked about in Arsenal for Democracy before, created their own exchanges. And, you know, there's examples like I think Illinois had one. There's Cover Oregon, which is the one in Oregon. And a lot of them basically were partly just to differentiate from the Affordable Care Act and the association with it being quote-unquote Obamacare. So the sort of flagship one of these that seems to be impressing everyone and was impressing people before it even launched was this one in Kentucky called, I guess, Connect, K-Y-N-E-C-T. Nice play on words there with their state. And they, you know, were trying to pitch this for quite a while, basically get people to think of it as an in-state thing, which it is, instead of it being the dastardly communist Obamacare from the central planning office in D.C. And so, you know, the story here is that they put together their own insurance exchange, as every state is allowed to do. And the site is working really well, and people are having you know, no problems as far as we know signing up for health insurance through there. And of course, you know, there never was a federal insurance plan, so it's still the same whether it's through the state level or the state website or a federal website. But Kentucky decided to build their own website instead of relying on the federal website, and that, of course, in given the circumstances, looked like it seems to have been the right call. Sasha, what were your thoughts on kind of the big picture angle from this story about how it's working out in Kentucky?
What I basically took away from this is that, I mean, the logical conclusion is that the more a state embraces the Affordable Care Act the way it was designed, the better health coverage their constituents will get, and overall, the more healthcare that people don't have it will be able to have better access to it, I guess. And Kentucky did it right. You know, a lot of the states, especially those with Republican governors, you know, denied a lot of the provisions, and because of that, the people that live there are suffering, and they can't get the healthcare that, you know, Obamacare intended. So I think the main takeaway for me is that, you know, it works when you do what you're supposed to, and that's, you know, embrace it. So I think Kentucky definitely did that right for starters.
Right. You know, as I said, they have actually set up their own exchange website, not just an informational website. Some states like Delaware, you know, I found it puzzling that they didn't have their own exchange. It was just a website basically pointing toward the federal website and giving you a little bit of contextualizing information. I think it makes more sense to build your own site to meet your state's needs, especially since it is ultimately still done through the state, because that's how insurance is regulated in this country for health insurance. So, you know, and you were mentioning about this kind of divide between Democratic implementation and Republican implementation. A lot of this comes down to the legislatures, but specifically it comes down to the governors in many cases. We also saw, for example, that the governor of Ohio, with some various finagling that has produced screeches of unconstitutionality from the very upset Republican Party of Ohio. He, you know, he's this bedrock conservative guy who was known for just slashing appropriations wildly when he was in the U.S. House back after the Republican takeover in the early 90s. And he's now finagled it so that they can expand Medicaid coverage in Ohio. And that's going to cover a huge number of people. I don't know the stat in front of me right now, but it was, you know, for one state, it was a pretty impressive chunk of people just by accepting the Medicaid expansion. You didn't even have to provide extra money from your own state. It was all going to come from the federal government, but the Supreme Court ruling made it optional. And again, it's surprising to see these Republican governors. Well, it's great to see a few Republican governors like in Ohio and Arizona accepting these expansions. But it's puzzling to see some of them not accepting these things when they're given the option, whether it's the Medicaid expansion or the option to create their own insurance exchange site. In fact, the governor of Kentucky, Steve Beshear, is a Democrat, and he pushed this through with an executive order over the repeated objections of the Republican legislature, according to an article from Talking Points memo on October 28th by Dylan Scott. Beshear had to really kind of ram this through with executive orders, despite many votes to try to prevent it from the Republican-dominated legislature. And they were being so obstinate about it that they even tried to block the agency from setting up office space to manage the exchange. How petty is that? And he went ahead with it anyway over their objections, got this exchange set up, and it's working out great for people. People are able to enroll. So, you know, this is definitely well-deserved that he got a call from the president commending him on his work here. But I think it's great to see this Democratic governor showing them how it's done when these Republican legislators are busy basically trying to hurt their own state and their own people. They were given an option to do this on their own terms, in their own way, and they tried to fight it. And, you know, that brings us to another angle here, which is this irony of the states' rights side of it, right? So, you know, they're always crying about the federal government getting too big and that they want things to be reserved to the states. And here you've got all these states that are refusing to build their own exchanges and are therefore dependent on a federal exchange system. You know, once it's passed, it's passed. It's here. You can't pretend that it's not here. So why not go and do your customization and your individual tailoring? And clearly, I think it's working out in this case to have done it independently. And I think that's true for other states that did it independently as well. And so now you've got, you know, red states like Kentucky and blue states like Massachusetts that, of course, had its own system before the Affordable Care Act. And you've got all these different states from across the spectrum pursuing the states' rights agenda, even in states like Massachusetts that don't seem like they would, right? And it's working out for them. And then you've got all these other states that are refusing to do this for various reasons and are surrendering their ability to control this to the federal government, which, of course, is not handling it as well as could be hoped right now. Now, Sasha, you also wanted to talk a little bit about the design aspect, and I did as well. What were you thinking about that?
I just, you know, took a quick glance at it. I didn't really try to enroll or anything, but it is right. very simple. You know, there's just simple buttons, you know, enroll here, let's get started. There's different tabs for individuals, for small businesses and that sort of thing. And there's not too much text. A lot of these sites tend to just like blast information at you and that sort of thing. They have very simple graphics, very simple text. I think it makes it easy for people to kind of figure out which category they fall into and the easiest way for them to get their individual health insurance. So I think you had some more technical observations about how it's easier to use and in that aspect, it's a better design.
Right. So they had a quote here from the Kentucky Exchange spokesperson, right? And she said, "We wanted to have it to have a branded feel, but that was not the most important part. The most important part was that it works. I think a lot of people would say that simplicity is good website design." And specifically, according to this Talking Points memo article, it says, quote, "From a design standpoint, Kentucky made the conscious choice to stick to the basics rather than seeking to blow users away with a state-of-the-art consumer interface. A big part of that was knowing their demographics. A simpler site would make it easier to access for people without broadband internet access, and the content was written at a sixth grade reading level, so it would be as easy to understand as possible." I mean, that makes it sound a little bit patronizing, but the intent is correct there, that you want the people who need to be able to get this insurance to be able to get this insurance, right? And that is both in terms of not blasting information, like Sasha said, at people, and also it's making it technically easier to use because a lot of Kentuckians still don't have broadband internet access, like many rural areas in the country, and the state is still predominantly rural. So there's plenty of people in Kentucky who do have access to that, but you got to make it so that everyone has equal access to it. And like Sasha said, if you look at the site, again, you don't have to try to enroll non-Kentuckians out there, but you can just look at the homepage, you can see that it is a very simplistic design. It looks like it's easy to use, and it's not like it looks like it's from 1996 and has flashing animated, cartoons and WAV files playing in the background, right? So, it's still a modern website. Maybe it looks a little bit older than some of the government websites you might be used to seeing, but and it's not like cutting edge, state of the art or anything like that. But it looks like it works fine. It's simple, and it does look, it has that elegant simplicity, right? So, and that has certainly made it a lot easier and less crash prone to operate and use than the federal version. And again, this is an opportunity that states had to do their own thing and make it work right, and they chose, and some a lot of them chose not to. The majority of them apparently chose not to do that. It seems like they would have benefited from taking Kentucky's approach rather than trying to just rely on the federal side. And of course, there's also the fact that the governor basically started pushing this through as soon as that Supreme Court decision came down in the summer of 2012 or late spring of 2012, that said that they were upholding this part of the Affordable Care Act. And they, had a lot of testing stuff that went into it, as should happen with any website like this, but apparently didn't happen with the federal website for many reasons and at many points. But they mention here in this article about all the different testing points that they did, and they were testing different individual steps to make sure it all worked. And they were doing extensive actual sort of field testing, beta testing of it from July through September so that it was ready to launch at the beginning of October so that people could actually enroll. And in terms of the statistics, they said that, and this is what's been getting Kentucky a lot of attention here, is that in Kentucky alone, 26,000 people have enrolled in coverage, more than 50,000 have started applications, and more than 300,000 unique visitors have checked out what the marketplace has to offer. This is according to the Talking Points memo article. And so they have 625,000 uninsured people. And if 300,000 people have already looked at it, that's a pretty promising statistic that shows that they kind of knew what they were doing. And they've already got, clearly are blowing away the numbers that we're seeing from the federal side, or not seeing because they aren't releasing a lot of those numbers. But, this is proportionally a lot more successful than the federal side. It seems like did this the right approach. And so I think that the takeaways here, to re-summarize, is that embracing the Affordable Care Act seems to make it work better, shockingly, that Democrats are handling this better than Republicans who are trying to push this away or hamper these efforts, that states that pursued this kind of states' rights option, it's working out better than the federal option, but ironically, a lot of the people that are traditionally associated with that ideology haven't embraced it. And finally, that this kind of design and architecture was put together a lot better and tested a lot better, and they kind of took a very good approach toward building that worked for their demographics and their needs in their state. And that is why Kentucky is working out as well as it is compared to the federal system.
I just wanted to real quick touch back on just the irony of it all, the fact that Republican governors and Republican state legislatures have just been so focused on denying every possible aspect of the Affordable Care Act that, you know, if they had taken the time to just create something that they liked better in their own marketplace and that sort of thing, you know, there could have been more wins than loses, I think, overall. And so it's just one of those frustrating but ironic sort of things.
Well, Sasha, thank you so much for joining us again here on Arsenal for Democracy.
Always a pleasure, Bill.
Sasha and I spoke on October 29th about the healthcare exchanges and specifically Kentucky's. But there's been some more developments in the past week regarding the overall exchanges and some of the controversy over the central one not working, as well as some of the consequences of the state ones. Now, I mentioned in the segment with Sasha that numbers had not been provided by the Department of Health and Human Services about how many people had signed up through the federal exchange at healthcare.gov. And the reason for this was partly because they wanted to not reveal how bad the numbers were, but partly it was just because the numbers were bad because of the technical failures that had plagued the site in its early launch phases and maybe continue to cause problems, although it's unclear what the status is for most people at this point going through the national site. But they did end up having some hearings over the website, and of course the big headline that came out of that was that only 6 people nationwide had signed up for health insurance through the Affordable Care Act. Well, of course, it's worth remembering a couple points about that. First of all, this is only referring to the federal site, which again had all these problems, as opposed to some of the state-based insurance exchanges like the ones that Sasha and I discussed or ones that we've mentioned previously on episodes of Arsenal for Democracy, including in Oregon, Indiana, California, etc. Plenty of people are signing up for health insurance through these other states, and that's brought us around to the second big so-called controversy that's come out this in the past week. And that is the controversy about the line that President Obama used when pushing the bill and when running for re-election that was, if you like your health insurance, you can keep it. Now, to my mind, since the system was aimed at helping people who did not have health insurance already, and then also in terms of saving money for people who did have health insurance but had it privately through through some individual or small group plan as opposed to through a large corporation, I assumed that that line was meant to assuage the concerns of people who had good health insurance through their jobs and their companies, you know, these big corporate health insurance plans. And so there was a lot of misinformation going around, and I assumed that the idea behind the line was that people who weren't, it wasn't going to affect them because they didn't need individual health insurance, that they were going to get to keep their health insurance, and he wanted to make sure people knew that. But apparently everyone else has been interpreting it that this meant everyone was going to get to keep their health insurance if they liked it. But of course that, you know, brings up the question of what health insurance they're keeping and how much do they really like it. There was a good Think Progress article by Igor Volsky on October 31st, and the headline for that was How to Spot a Fake Obamacare Horror Story. And so this was about the people who have been running various op-eds and articles in papers like the Wall Street Journal that are opposed to the Affordable Care Act, as well as some other mainstream media outlets that sort of like to stoke the fires of controversy in Washington. And his article here was about identifying the key things that show you what's wrong with a lot of these stories that are supposedly showing the terribleness that's resulting from the Affordable Care Act and these health insurance exchanges. A lot of this really comes down to the fact that there were people who had privately purchased individual insurance plans that weren't very good, but they were what was available to them, and they are no longer going to be able to keep those plans even if they liked it because the plans are no longer compliant with the federal requirements under the Affordable Care Act, and this is somehow supposed to be a bad thing, or the insurance companies have decided to change their business model in regards to this plan, or they're simply not offering that plan anymore for a variety of reasons. And all of these factors are sort of converging to create these stories of people who are like, I loved my health insurance and that I never used, and now I'm not going to be able to have it anymore because I'm going to have to get a better plan. And of course, then there's the thing, oh, but it's going to cost more if it's a better plan. Well, not necessarily. Certain health insurance companies are certainly, of course, raising their premiums to as they add in features to get themselves into minimum compliance of coverage options under the Affordable Care Act requirements. But they are also not telling you that you can go look at through these health insurance exchanges, particularly in the states like Kentucky, where we talked about where the health insurance exchanges are actually working totally fine. And you can look and see across competitors as well as staying within your own plan. And that was the whole point of that line was if you like it, you can keep it. The idea being that if you looked at another option and you still liked it, then you could then you would be able to keep it. But you probably wouldn't because you'd probably see an option that you liked better. That was the whole idea of the health insurance exchange. I don't know why it's such a hard concept for people, but the idea here is that if you had to purchase individual health insurance and you already had it, right, that this was also going to save you money because you were going to be able to compare different levels of plans within the company that you already had your insurance from, and you were going to be able to compare insurance plans from other rival companies because, according to the free market principles behind this whole idea in the first place, you were going to, free market competition was going to reduce prices for everyone and so on and so forth. There's also subsidies, which we talked about a couple weeks ago here on Arsenal for Democracy, this idea that if you're above the qualification levels for Medicaid, or if your state didn't do that expansion, if you're above all those levels, then you're going to qualify for a subsidy up to a certain level, and that's going to help you qualify for a bronze plan in most cases. There's those different levels there, and there is even a plan below bronze. But in a lot of cases, the idea here, and this seems to be bearing out in practice when people really dig into these so-called horror stories, is that in most cases, the person is upset that their plan is either going to get more expensive or not be offered anymore because it didn't really offer almost anything at all to begin with, and now they have to choose between plans that actually offer some things so that they're going to get something for their money or indeed save money in the long run, because if they actually get sick and have to use it, they're going to save a lot of money that way because the out-of-pocket costs are reduced, even if the premiums are slightly higher. And with the subsidies, a lot of people's premiums are not, in fact, going to be as high as the sticker price would indicate. That's the whole idea behind this. And in a lot of cases, people aren't – assuming – that they actually go look at the health insurance exchange, and in the federal case, that's going to have to wait until, that's available. But people are going to have information, they're going to be able to see the competition, and they're going to be able to figure out what is the best option for them. And in probably the vast, vast majority of cases, if you already had private health insurance, you're going to get something better, and you're going to get something cheaper through this system. And as I said, so far what we know indicates that this is in fact the case, that this is happening in practice, especially in the states that have their own health insurance exchanges where people are able to compare these figures. And I also want to, reiterate the point that I've mentioned before on the show. One of the things that somehow doesn't get much attention at all in all of these discussions of the Affordable Care Act is that there is that one crucial provision that says that the private insurance companies cannot spend more than 20% of your insurance premium each month on things like administrative costs and compensation packages for their upper management and on advertising. They have to spend at least 80% of your premiums on actually providing healthcare to people, paying for healthcare that people like you need. And in many cases, they are already sending refund checks that they are legally required to do if they spent more than that amount in a given month. We've heard a lot from the state of California about that, where it's particularly being strongly enforced. And we're going to be seeing that in a lot of other states as well. These are measures that are going to keep people's premium costs down. They're going to keep these costs in control, and they're going to help reduce the cost of healthcare in the United States. The Think Progress article says, when you're hearing these stories about how terrible the Obamacare is for people's individual health insurance plans, you got to ask yourself four questions about these stories. One, what did the person's old plan actually cover? Two, did the person go to the exchanges and actually go and compare different plans that were available? Three, if their old plan had low premiums, what were the co-pays and deductibles? If they went for, you know, some minor preventative treatment or something, how much did they have to pay out of pocket there? If they had to go for something bigger, what was the amount that they had to pay there? And of course, you know, it used to be that you could barely compare between any of these plans. So for all you know, you did have an amazing plan, or you had a terrible plan, and you really had no way to know. No way to tell the difference. Now we have a way because we can compare, you know, the Blue Cross plan or the Aetna plan or the United Healthcare plan or the Highmark plan or any number of different companies. You could actually go and compare and say, okay, this is a bronze level plan or this is a silver level plan or this is a gold level plan. Here's my percentage of cost that I'm going to have to pay out of pocket, you know, as deductibles or co-pays as the case may be. And now I have a way of comparing how much the different plans cost, and I can clearly see itemized what's going to be covered in each of them. And the fourth question is, do people qualify for subsidies? If they're talking about how expensive this new plan is going to be, do they actually qualify for federal subsidies? But for some reason, in this country, as seems to happen on so many issues, this is a situation where there are a lot of people who are determined to resent something and determined to oppose something and are convinced that any change is going to be bad change, and therefore they are going to drag their heels and be upset about this, even though it may in fact be providing them with better options. They are so convinced that the so-called Obamacare is going to be worse for them that they're not willing to even go look and figure out if they can get a better plan. They're so convinced that they love their insurance that they're not even considering the fact that their garbage, catastrophic insurance that they had in many cases, especially in a lot of these stories we're hearing about, these people with their catastrophic insurance that barely covered anything unless they completely, you know, got into a huge grievous accident in 1 year or something, that those people, they've been paying money for something that barely exists, and now they're going to be paying money, probably less money in fact, or not that much more, to get actual services, because that's the whole point, is that they're going to be reining in the cost through the Affordable Care Act, as we've talked about on this show before, and they're going to be bringing down the cost through competition as well as regulations, and they're going to be requiring these insurance plans to actually cover some things that they had basically been refusing to cover. After this break, we'll talk more about the reaction we're seeing to the Affordable Care Act and how some of it just doesn't add up. Stick around for more Arsenal for Democracy from BillHumphreyResearch.com/radio and WVUD in just a moment. I'm Bill Humphrey. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. This hour, we've been talking about the Affordable Care Act and the continuing unreasonable opposition to it coming from some quarters. There are some people who are absolutely determined, despite any facts to the contrary, to be embittered about something and convinced that it's confiscatory socialism that's going to take away their fundamental right to have terrible health insurance or their fundamental right even to have no health insurance at all. And push that cost onto the rest of us who do have health insurance and the rest of us who have to go to the hospital and, you know, pay increased costs because they were using the emergency room for something that didn't need emergency care because they lacked health insurance. The system in the United States does not work. This is a step in the right direction. It's not a step that is a complete one by any means. It's not a huge step, but it's a step in the right direction. And kicking and screaming all the way doesn't help anything. Yeah, there are indeed some people who are going to have to pay more, probably not a lot more given the structuring system, you know, and people are going to maybe drop down to a bronze plan instead of their silver equivalent plan. But now for the first time, we have a way to compare all these different plans, both within a company vertically and horizontally at the same level across multiple companies. That's going to promote competition, and that, according to our Republican friends 20 years ago, is what's going to bring down the costs on this health insurance system and start to get some of these things under control. And convincing yourself that you're going to have to give up your fabulous plan that you probably didn't have is kind of the definition of insanity at this point. But, you know, it's something that apparently a lot of Americans like to do, which is convince themselves of some alternate reality instead of actually looking into the facts or finding out something for themselves. They get an idea in their head about what something's like, and then they don't let any information in to change their opinions and change their views. And then you've got, you know, the whole leadership core, too, that doesn't like to change their opinion on anything because that's flip-flopping. And, you know, I'm sure I'm a huge flip-flopper because I'm sure if you go through Arsenal for Democracy or my previous show, I'm sure you're going to find things where I changed my mind on something because either the circumstances changed or I learned some new piece of information or something like that, or I got more experience in the real world. But, you know, that's not the American way. The American way is you get an opinion and you stick with that opinion no matter what facts come along that might change that or change the situation, because you're so determined to figure out, you know, how to continue having this view that you have or continue having this terrible health insurance plan that you already had because, you know, you loved having it so much. They're now required to cover a lot more things that they used to not have to cover. And yeah, sometimes that makes your premiums go up. I mean, it's shocking to think that you might have to actually pay a little bit extra to be able to qualify for something that you would actually really benefit from having access to. And, you know, in the long run, it's going to bring the average cost down for everyone. So yes, a few people are going to have to probably pay more under this system. But collectively, we're all going to be doing much better, and a lot of people are going to have access to care that they previously didn't have. I mean, that's the problem in the United States, is we've had this system that's focused on basically giving people with lots of money all the care they could possibly need, and arguably more from the excessive defensive medicine, you know, over-treating things for liability reasons or vanity reasons or whatever. Now we're working toward, you know, we're not there yet, but we're gradually working toward a system where the income isn't the barrier to being able to access care in this country. It shouldn't be. There should be, everyone should be able to have a minimum level of access to certain basic care things. And the fact that we had a system where not only were 40 million people uninsured, but you had a lot of people who were barely insured and could hardly get any of these basic services, that's a real problem. I mean, some people apparently don't see that as a real problem, but I see that as a real problem. You know, I mean, that gets into the veil of ignorance theories by Rawls and stuff, which is, how would you design a society if you were going to be born into a society at any level within the hierarchy, and you didn't know, you had no control over, you know, what level you were gonna enter into? Well, you know, you wouldn't necessarily create some communitarian equal income paradise or anything like that. No one's really suggesting that. You know, there are various advantages to having social strata and ladders to climb and things like that. But Rawls's concept was that if you're designing a society from behind the veil of ignorance, you're going to want to have at least the bottom rung at a sort of basic minimum quality of life standard. I mean, is it really too much to ask that we all chip in a little bit extra so that everyone gets at least basic health insurance that legitimately covers some actual treatments and preventive care, so that we can all at least have that basic level of health care in this country? Seems to me that's only fair, but, you know, some people seem to think that fair is a bad word, or that, you know, life isn't meant to be fair, and we should do our hardest to make sure that it continues to stay unfair, because unfairness is the way the world works, instead of trying to make it better. Which, to me, it seems like as long as we're here in the world, we should probably be trying to make it better if we have the capacity to do so. If we don't have the capacity to do so, then hopefully other people who do have the capacity will help us. But, you know, why are we here fundamentally if we're not trying to make the world a better place? You know, other lower forms of life, you know, they go through their procreation processes and create future generations, and that's their entire goal. And some of these house flies and whatever go through those processes in a matter of hours or 24 hours or whatever, and that's their whole life cycle. And obviously, We evolved to be able to do other more elaborate things and have all kinds of elaborate communications and build societies and build civilizations, and we put people on the moon, and we've done all kinds of truly spectacular things despite all the terrible things that we've done to each other as human beings. It seems to me that one of the goals that we should all be trying to pursue, if we have the means to do so, is to make the world a better place collectively. Not just for some of us or just for our children and grandchildren, but kind of for everyone's. That's really the only way that anything gets better. And typically, when people have taken actions that benefit all mankind or have a collective good for a large area of society, the result has generally been very clear that everyone benefits, including the people at the top of the ladder. They, you know, if you're working to establish those minimum standards of living and minimum quality of life for the people at the bottom, all those people have more money to spend on the consumer economy. They have more means to participate in society as a whole. And we are all enriched both economically and socially, I guess you could say. And that is a benefit for all. There was an article recently that I was reading on Slate.com about this idea of why does Sweden have so many millionaires and billionaires? And obviously it's a much smaller country than the United States, which certainly has a lot of billionaires, but Sweden is pretty high up on the per capita list. And they're also, although income inequality has been increasing in Sweden in the past 10 years, by a much smaller degree than say in the United States, where median income has fallen 8.9% in the last 13 years. The Swedish system has kind of made it so that there is still very clear social strata and a ladder to climb, but everyone is at a minimum baseline and can participate in the society fully and isn't constantly, you know, worrying about being on the brink, and they can pursue various other innovative ideas and start their own businesses and things like that. I mean, isn't that what the United States is supposed to be about, theoretically? That, you know, we can all participate to the fullest and strike out on our own and be entrepreneurial and start our own businesses and things like that. I mean, that was one of the whole ideas of this push for health reform, even broader than the Affordable Care Act, was this idea that we could free up the people to move between jobs and move between careers and strike out on their own to start a small business without, you know, being totally uninsured. That was supposed to be something that would promote the core concepts that makes the United States the United States. It's, the dark side, of course, can be some of the more braggy and inappropriate American exceptionalist behavior, but we've also got the good aspects, the more achievable aspects of the American dream. And of course, you know, I did my research a couple years ago on American dream rhetoric, so I'm pretty familiar with the different strands of how people argue it. But I know that the way that I would argue it is that, you know, there is that individualist spirit, but there's also that collective spirit, the same spirit that, you know, we're going to be coming up now on the on Thanksgiving in a few weeks, and we're going to be thinking about the Pilgrims, and then subsequently the Puritans and the other folks in Massachusetts Bay Colony and all those other colonies. And, you know, they weren't perfect by a long shot, and in fact did some terrible things, certainly, as many people were pointing out not so long ago on Columbus Day weekend, as happens every year, rightfully so. But these folks understood something very fundamental, you know, especially the Puritans. And their preachers, you know, when they weren't off burning witches or persecuting adulterers and adulteresses in Nathaniel Hawthorne books, they were making that fundamental point, which is that everyone's got to pull their weight in society. We have better odds of survival if we're all working together and all pulling our weight. But the flip side of everyone pulling their weight is it's not just saying, oh, hey, poor people over there, you're not working hard enough, you got to pull your weight. It's also telling the people who have more means and are more fortunate and can rely on themselves that they also have to contribute to society, that they also have to be a part of this American society. I was talking with someone recently about the title of that, you know, famous libertarian tome that those libertarians love, Atlas Shrugged. I mean, think about the the concept of the word shrugged, all the meaning that's implied there, that was a conscious choice. It's this idea that Atlas just gave up because he didn't care anymore. Now, I mean, in the Greek myth, Atlas is carrying the entire world on his shoulders. So you're telling me that if someone has the means to carry the entire world on their shoulders, that it's somehow responsible or acceptable for them to go, eh, I don't care, dump the world off my back. And, you know, in that novel, they've got the whole concept of going galt, where all the rich people just collectively shrug and cease to care because they're tired of carrying everyone else on their backs and they just disappear. I mean, really, that's acceptable, but it's not acceptable for someone who's barely making ends meet, if that, to, you know, get some assistance from the government to help them get back on their feet. Apparently, it's perfectly acceptable if you have tons of money to just go, whatever, I don't care, I'm going to leave now. That's the problem. Wealth isn't distributed equally in American society. And nobody's really arguing in favor of distributing it equally. But the flip side, if you don't distribute it equally, is that the people who have the means have to sometimes chip in so that collectively we all are advantaged. And, you know, the whole pitch behind the crazy supply-side economics theories that don't really make a whole lot of sense was you give the tax breaks to the rich people and that, you know, then they create jobs and everyone's advantage. Now, in practice, that doesn't seem to work that way, unsurprisingly. Those people, instead of creating jobs, tend to just put it into stock market speculation, especially in the past 20 years or so. But if you accepted the premise of the principle of supply-side economics, right? The idea is that the rich people are chipping in. Now, they're not being mandated necessarily to chip in, but the concept is that they're supposed to be, that they're not supposed to just go galt and completely abdicate responsibility. If you have means in this society, whether it's modest means, or you're fairly comfortable, or you're just barely ahead of someone else, or you've got vast quantities of wealth in your favorite 10-story bungalow in the Cayman Islands that's home to 1,000 corporations, you have some level of responsibility to help out people that aren't as fortunate as you. And again, it's a degrees of relativity. So in some cases, you know, many people who are just, you know, kind of living a little bit above the edge, they often help out people around them who aren't as fortunate as them, even though they don't have a lot to go around. That's, you know, the whole collective thought here. But certainly there's a divergence in approach to how you achieve that. And you've got a lot of people saying, oh, well, we should rely on private charity, or it's not the government's role to enforce it. But the government is the one who can figure out how to distribute the collective burden and the collective rewards in a way that most advantageously accelerates or enhances economic growth. And that is pretty fundamentally a better role of the government. You know, you've got the same people who are saying that we shouldn't be taxing the rich, or we shouldn't be pursuing some of these slightly redistributive programs, but they're the ones who are backing the, you know, huge corporations on the premise of economies of scale, which is a legitimate economic principle. You know, that the bigger corporation can lower their costs by doing things on a truly huge scale rather than a sort of artisanal scale in a shop in Williamsburg, whether we're talking about Williamsburg as in colonial or hipster. But, you know, the economies of scale is something that does hold true, and the government is going to be inherently better at it in figuring out where the help is most needed when their role is to provide for the national society and to look out for everyone on a collective basis rather than targeting it specifically. And I think the role of government is going to become even more important than ever in this country, because we've seen all those statistics about the so-called great sort that's happening, where everyone is sorting themselves into communities that are very similar politically, socioeconomically, racially, certainly. There's a lot of factors here that are definitely at play, and these are going to continue to get worse as this sorting continues. And the sorting is going to be continuing to become a problem And that's the consequence of that problem is that people are going to have less and less exposure to people who are different from themselves, whether it's economic levels or racially or anything else. They're not going to have exposure to these different types of people, and they're not going to see the people who necessarily need help. There's a reason that we see people being a lot more socially liberal and in fact economically liberal as well in cities, because people in cities have a lot more daily exposure to people at various different economic strata. I mean, think about New York City. You've got the fantastically wealthy Wall Street bankers, you know, who are setting money on fire, and then you've got the homeless person right outside. These are something that you're not going to see as much as people sort themselves into these very cloistered communities. And that ultimately becomes a problem that is only solved when you have this overseeing body that is responsible for everyone, in this case, the national federal government in the United States. Though that's going to be an increasing role of government, not a decreasing role of government, because you're not, as a private charity, you know, or a collective group that's privately trying to help people, you're going to not see the people nearest you, even when they might live in the county next to you, because you never deal with these people on a regular basis. But the government, you know, the all-seeing eye of Sauron, according to these Republicans, you know, their role is to be able to see all these things happening at once and send the money where it needs to go. And that's why, you know, I see the, you know, the course that takes us from those Puritan Jeremiads telling everyone that they have to work together or the wilderness is going to swallow them. I see how that develops into people saying, yeah, but look, we should just continue to do it through our churches like they did, you know, or that there's no role for government here, or that we can handle this privately. But of course, that was the 1600s dealing with a very small community. So philosophically and in principle, that's on the right track. This idea that we need to be looking out for each other and be our neighbor's keeper and help pull our weight equally and all work together, because if we all work together, that's how we achieve the American dream. But when you then try to implement that in practice, that's where you're going to need a bigger role for the federal government here. And that's why, you know, we're trying to work toward legislation like the Affordable Care Act. That's the whole principle here at work.
Arsenal for Democracy will be right back in just a moment from BillHumphreyResearch.com/radio and WVUD. I'm Bill Humphrey. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Before we wrap up the show this week, I wanted to talk about one particular news story and ongoing issue that I think people can actually make perhaps a substantive difference on. And this is the issue of the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which has been going back and forth in Congress to not very much effect for the past, I think, 17 years now. Now, this is a bill that proposes to pass a law that, according to a poll that Huffington Post just released with YouGov in the last week, that 69% of Americans already think is something that exists. Basically, the proposal would make it illegal for people to be fired for being gay, or more broadly, anywhere in the LGBT spectrum and hopefully beyond those particular designations. But, you know, those are the ones that are specifically covered. And again, 69% of Americans already think that this is a law. And in many states, a majority, I think about 29 at this point, there are at least some, if not full, protections along those lines for people who fall under those categories, or are even suspected of falling under those categories by their employers who aren't very tolerant. This would basically mean a federal law that makes this standard in every state that you can't be fired for being gay or for being transgendered. And that is a really crucial step for, you know, creating these basics, basic rights, basic standard of living, etc., in the United States. And a lot of folks are not covered by this if they live in states that don't have those state-level protections, or the state-level protections don't go as far as the federal levels would. Now, the federal proposal doesn't affect things related to the military. It doesn't affect
religious organizations. But for everyone else, this would prevent people from being fired just for being LGBT. It got 60 votes Monday, November 4th, for the first time ever through the U.S. Senate. A few Republicans had been working on this for a while. At least one or two others jumped on board at the last minute, providing those critical votes to avoid a filibuster. So the U.S. Senate, for the first time ever, passed the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. And immediately, Speaker Boehner in the U.S. House said that he wasn't interested in working on this, that people can't get fired for being gay, you know, that they're already protected under various federal laws, which is not, in fact, the case. And so even though this is something that a majority of Americans want and an even bigger majority already think is on the books, he doesn't seem willing to entertain this idea, which is unfortunate, but, of course, predictable. Now, a lot of times on this show, of course, I'm pretty doom and gloom about the prospects of things getting through this particular Republican House or the previous Republican House, both under Speaker Boehner. But the fact is that this is not necessarily the end of the line, just that Speaker Boehner is totally unwilling to consider this. First of all, the great thing is that the Senate passed this in the, you know, fall of 2013 instead of the fall of 2014. So we've still got a while to be able to work on this and hopefully get something done. So that means that, you know, potentially Boehner could be lobbied to change his mind, although I really don't see that happening. More realistically, there's the option of what's called a discharge petition, which is this idea where you bring something to the floor if you get a majority of people to sign a letter saying that it should be brought to a vote. Now, you know, originally this was created and exists in many state legislatures as well as a provision for, like, the leadership is not supporting something really popular or has some pet peeve against it or something like that, or a majority of the chamber at least thinks that it should be brought up for discussion, or they want to get it out of a committee that it's stuck in. And in the U.S. House of Representatives, the leadership of the majority has exceptional control over both the schedule and what gets any kind of vote at all. And they also get to control through the Rules Committee all kinds of procedural things, like how long people get to talk in favor of it and against, and all kinds of things like that. So the leadership does have an enormous amount of control. But if you can somehow get a majority of the House of Representatives on board with something that the leadership is unwilling to support, it will end up getting brought to a vote. And so I decided to look up and see kind of what the prospects were of getting this through. You know, it was a bipartisan bill out of the U.S. Senate and had some, you know, pretty active Republican support from Orrin Hatch, who's a senator from Utah, very conservative senator. So to my mind, there's at least a chance of getting, you know, some Republicans on board in the House. And I was kind of curious to see how many that would actually be needed. And it was not as many as I really had thought. Again, you have to have a majority sign the letter to, you know, you already have to have a majority in place, or at least a majority willing to hear the bill before you can get it brought through a discharge petition to the floor for a vote. So in the U.S. House, that means you're going to need to get 218 people on board. And with the Republicans controlling a majority, it's not that big of a majority, but that means that it is somewhat difficult, but it's not necessarily out of the range of possibility. If you get all the Democrats on board, which again isn't a complete guarantee, and then you get some Republicans on board. And I looked on the bill tracker on govtrack.us for the House version of this bill, which is H.R. 1755. And according to the latest figures that they had updated for the House side, this bill already has 193 co-sponsors. Now, 188 of those are Democrats, and only 5 of them are Republicans. If you want to know who the Republicans are, so you know not to hassle them if they happen to be your members of Congress, that's a pretty easy list to go through, as opposed to the long, long list of Democrats. You know, and I would say go to govtrack.us to look up the Democrats list if you're curious to see if yours is on there. But the list of Republicans, again, is pretty short, so I'll just go through it now. Charlie Dent from Pennsylvania's 15th District, Richard Hanna from New York's 22nd District, Elena Ross Latinen from Florida's 27th, and John Runyon from New Jersey's 3rd, and Chris Gibson from New York's 19th. Those are the five Republicans that are supporting this. So, you know, that brings the total up to 193 co-sponsors. Those are people who have already put their names on this bill as willing to support it. And again, you can figure out there, if you're not doing the math along in your head already, you probably have figured out that 193, while short of 218, isn't all that far away. And the exact number is 25. So they just need 25 more votes. That either means rounding up a few more Democrats, because I don't know exactly if there's any Democrats left on the table, and it means getting some of the moderate Republicans on board. So if you have a Republican congressman or congresswoman in your district, and they are not in that list of five people, that means that they are potentially people who could come on board as co-sponsors or signatories to the discharge petition. And of course, you know, some of you live in districts with completely crazy, you know, wildly anti-gay legislators who are never going to come around on this. But again, this is something that a majority of Americans support, a majority of Americans, an even bigger majority, think already is on the books, and therefore they don't have a problem with it. This is true for independents, for Democrats and Republicans in the base. This is a bill that Americans support and think should happen. And most Republicans, even if they don't support marriage equality or various other issues, they do accept that people shouldn't be able to be fired for being gay. And that is an angle that you can use to try to persuade your legislator. So if your legislator isn't already on that list, particularly if they're a Republican legislator, give them a call. Go to, you know, house.gov, look up their specific page. It'll have phone numbers. Give them a call. Let them know that you support this and try to encourage them to consider signing a discharge petition on HR 1755, you know, or the Senate bill if they go directly to the Senate bill. And that way, hopefully this can get brought up for a vote. They only need 25 more people. And they have a year more to work on it. So there's definitely time to get involved. But I wanted to bring this to people's attention if they hadn't heard about it yet. And, you know, and get on that. If you're in Delaware and you're listening to this, because this is a Delaware-based show, John Carney is a co-sponsor of the bill, so you don't need to contact him. And that is, you know, thank you very much to him for supporting that. But if you are one of my listeners who does not live in Delaware, whether you listen to the podcast or listen to WVUD, or you're someone in Delaware who knows people in those other districts, you know, pass this information along to them and encourage them to get involved and contact their Republican legislator, or if there's any Democrats left, their Democratic legislators, and get them on board with supporting the Employment Non-Discrimination Act in the House, getting a discharge petition to get that to a full vote. That's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy for November 4th, 2013. The show is recorded at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts weekly and is available for download from billhumphreyresearch.com/radio on Tuesdays. You can also hear a repeat of it on 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in Delaware, or stream it at WVUD.org every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man Justin and my guest commentator Sasha. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.